Well, hey, how are y'all? Good. I'm Carter. I'm one of the pastors here. Welcome, especially if you're new. Welcome if you're joining us online, or we're glad you're here in person as well. And I'm excited because we're starting a new series today called Sex, Marriage, and Singleness. So you can guess what it's about, all right? It's pretty straightforward. It's going to be a short three-week series on these three topics. So guess what the topic is for today? It starts with sex, all right? So I just want to say, in case you didn't get the email or see the social media post or the text that we sent this week, that this topic today can be sensitive for some, and we're calling it a little bit more of a PG-13 sermon, perhaps. I'm not going to be explicit, obviously, but I am going to talk about sexual topics since the topic itself is sex, and just be aware of that, especially if you have your kids in here. You might have to have a follow-up conversation after that, so that's just up to you, but next week, we'll be back to normal talking about marriage, and then the week after that, we'll talk about singleness, and it's all going to be from 1 Corinthians chapters 6 and 7. So you can turn to 1 Corinthians 6, verses 12 through 20 today. That's where we'll be, and I don't think I have to convince you guys at all that it's important to talk about sex, right? Like, I don't have to convince anybody of that. In our culture, it's the air we breathe, isn't it? I mean, every TV show, every movie, tons of books, marketing, commercials, video games, everything is saturated with sex and sexuality to the point that our very identity can be defined by who we want to have sex with, right? That's how it works in our culture. We're a hyper-sexualized culture, and in some sense, we kind of understand why sex is important and why the culture makes so much of it, because it's an important part of being human, isn't it? It's actually part of God's design for us. It's mentioned in the very beginning of creation, and it's given to us as one part of how we actually fulfill our purpose as human beings in the world, to bear God's image and to represent Him. It's very interesting that sex is a part of that. So sex is no small topic, but here in 1 Corinthians, as we get into it, you'll see that Paul deals with it very clearly. So it's not a small topic, but it's not a complicated topic either. And since we have a lot to cover, I'm just going to jump right into the text right now. We'll take a break in some of the sections and make some points as we go, but this is what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 to the Corinthian church. He said, "Everything is permissible for me, but not everything's beneficial. Everything is permissible for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. Food's for the stomach and stomach for food, and God will do away with them both. However, the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body." Now, before we go on to the rest of it, let's just stop here and try to understand what the situation is. The passage is in a larger context of the church of Corinthians, the letter to the church of Corinth, and it's about living like a Christian in a non-Christian culture. That's basically what Paul's writing the letter to them for. And he's answering questions as he goes along, and he's correcting issues that they were dealing with as he writes this letter. So we'll see that in chapter 7, verse 1. He even says, as you wrote to me about. So this section that we're going to focus on for the next 3 weeks is a standalone section where Paul answers questions about the topic of sex, marriage, and singleness. So he literally talks about that in this section. He's saying Christians should think about and practice sex differently than the culture. And so that's actually how we could sum up the series, if you want to write that down, because that's what the next 3 weeks are going to be about. Christians should think about and practice sex differently than the culture. That's what Paul's writing here in this section. If I had to sum up the series, that's how it would be. And it's, of course, very important. We have Valentine's Day this week coming up. Maybe it's good for us to talk about this, but obviously it's because of the air we breathe in our culture. We need to talk about this kind of thing. And he's talking about specifics on sex in this section, but in the overarching push of the whole letter, he's really pushing them to live in deep dependence on God and to worship God alone. You know, that should ring a bell for those of you who've been here in the weeks past, because that's kind of our theme for the entire year. That's what we want to focus on, is deep dependent worship. Well, Paul's writing that to the Corinthians here. It's all throughout his letter. It kind of culminates in 1 Corinthians 10:31 when he says, "So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do everything for the glory of God." That's kind of the summation of the entire letter here. So in this section on sex, it's no different for us. Their lives should be about the glory of God, including how they think about and practice sex. That's why he's talking about it. So let's write this down as our main point for today. If you're taking notes, this is the main point for this sermon. It's sex is for God's glory. Can I get an amen, okay? I mean, hello, have you ever heard a sermon point like that before, okay, in church? That's the main point for the sermon. Sex is for God's glory. And if that's true, man, it should change the way that we think about and practice sex. Sex not ultimately about making us feel a certain way or satisfying us in some way or making us feel loved in some way or whatever it is. It's not like that. It's about God. It's about God's glory in the world through our lives, how we think about it, how we practice it. So many people think Christians are somehow against sex, or at least good sex, right? You're against good, you can't have good sex. You're not going to have any fun, right? Puritan and all of that kind of stuff. But see, the Bible tells us that God intentionally made sex as part of being a human to bear his image. Sex done God's way will give him glory because he's the creator of it. The problem for the Corinthians and for us is that sex was just part of the air they breathed, as it is for us. If you know anything about Corinth in the first century as a city, I mean, it was a typical example of a sex-saturated culture, okay? What happened in Corinth stayed in Corinth, all right? That was their motto, okay? If you wanted to go back in that time, that's what you would hear. It's the sin city of Greece for them. I mean, it's the epicenter of all things hypersexual because it was in the middle of the peninsula, the Greek peninsula. If you think about Greece and it's got all the, you know, little arms and the little archipelagos and all that kind of stuff, it's right in the center of it on an isthmus. So it was a port city where goods and services were, you know, going in and out of the city. And then, of course, it was also a center for philosophy and religion. And, you know, each city kind of had a claim to fame for what kind of temple they had to whichever god was theirs. Well, their claim to fame was the temple to Aphrodite. Okay, and Aphrodite, of course, is the goddess of love and sex and pleasure. And so they had 1,000 prostitutes, temple prostitutes, in this temple. It's said that they had at least 1,000, if not more, that would be used for worship. There was even a saying that originated with a Roman poet called Horace. And he wrote this in one of his writings, not everybody's able to go to Corinth. Okay, and so basically what that means is not everybody can handle it there. All right, even for them back in those times, it was a lot. It was a lot to handle if you went to Corinth. Not everybody can handle a sex-saturated, hypersexualized, however you want to say it. So it was a constant battle. You just think about the Christians in Corinth. It was a constant battle for them to rightly understand God's design for sex and sexuality, right? Because illicit sex was so readily available to them. It was normal to go have sex at the temple with the prostitutes. They might have felt abnormal if they didn't because it was their culture. It was the air they breathed. And I know in our culture it's kind of similar, but especially with pornography. And I think that is that thing for us. It's the thing that's just hyper-normalized. You know, we may not have temples dedicated to sex, at least not any that we know about. Okay, maybe there are, but we don't see them on a regular basis. But we do have a multi-billion dollar industry across the world that's at the fingertips of anybody with an internet connection, right? I mean, unless you actively choose to put filters and safeties in place for yourself, you can get to pornography just like that. It's completely open. It's way easier than walking into a temple. I mean, at least in their time, you had to go to the temple, right? I mean, right now, you just carry the temple in your pocket with you, wherever you go. That's kind of how it works for us. I mean, in 2021, the porn industry generated $47.6 billion in revenue. It's expected to reach $72 billion in revenue by the year 2027. I mean, that's a number that's almost hard to grasp, but just to put it in comparison here, Netflix, right? Everybody knows Netflix. It only generated $31.6 billion, and that's still a lot of money. That's a lot of money. The NFL only generated $18 billion. I mean, porn is the most sought-after topic on the internet and probably has been and still will be for years to come. We're in a sex-saturated culture, and it only seems explicit to those of us, I think, who remember life without smartphones, or who remember life without immediate internet access in our pocket. Because I grew up in a time where you had to hear those three dings and the garbling sound to get on the internet. Remember that? It took you about 5 minutes to go ding, 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 or whatever it was, you know? You got really excited when you heard those dings, right? You're like, okay, now I'm going to get on the World Wide Web, right? You remember that terminology? See, my cell phone was the Nokia brick. That's what I had in high school. All right, it was the first cell phone I had. It did not get on the internet, I promise you that, okay? See, things were different back then, back in the old days. But do you think about our younger generation, especially because of social media and dating apps and unfiltered internet access and all the other stuff that goes on their phones? I mean, they've grown up in this hypersexualized culture, and that's not to say that it didn't exist back then, right? That would be absurd. Of course it did. All the way back since, you know, early times, people have been infatuated with sex, but it's just that it's so much more accessible. It's so in your face. It's there now. It's more accessible than it ever has been. I mean, there's an app now for a sexual rendezvous with other people looking for the same thing. People can just jump on that app and go hook up with whoever they want. It's pretty normal in our culture to do that, right? That's not abnormal for people to do. It's not taboo anymore. So we have generations now that are growing up in this hypersexuality, and it's being normalized and has been normalized for years, and that's exactly what the Corinthian culture was like. If you go back to that time, it's exactly like that. Hypersexualized. Everything was permissible, Paul quotes here. See, he's restating their questions to them. He does that three times here. And the first thing he says is, you say everything is permissible. That's basically what everything is permissible, you say. But then he has two responses to that. Not everything's beneficial, and we shouldn't be mastered by anything. So what Paul's doing here in his typical Paul savvy is he's starting with a reasonable argument. This is reason. He doesn't start by appealing to morals or to religion here. He's just starting with reason. And he says, not everything's beneficial. You know that, right? It's likely he's saying, it might be permissible in the culture, but it doesn't benefit everybody for you to be permissible with whatever you want to do, have sex with whoever, however, whenever. That's not good for everybody. You can hurt other people with your actions in the name of personal freedom. And then he points out you shouldn't be mastered by anything either. Some things that are permissible are addictive. They might become your master. You think that you're master over them and you're doing them because it's permissible. You're free. You're not free. You're enslaved, is what he's saying. That's what addiction does. That's what STDs do. It's a matter of personal health at some level. It's simple reason is all he's saying here in these two instances. So listen, if you're not a Christian here today, I mean, I'm glad you're here. So thankful that you're here. But you're going to do what you're going to do. I totally know that, right? I get that. You do what you do. It's fine. I hope you don't hear any of this as trying to archaically impose our religious beliefs on you or beat you over the head with the Bible in some way. It's permissible in our culture. Nobody's going to stop you from doing what you want to do. But just keep in mind, and you can write this down if you're taking notes, because this is basically what Paul's saying, and it's just a simple fact from reason. Sex outside of marriage will hurt you and others. That's just the truth. Sex outside of marriage will hurt you and others. The way I used to say, I taught sex ed for several years, and I actually created a sexual health and biblical health curriculum, biblical sexuality curriculum, when I was in Greensboro at the pregnancy center. And the way we used to say it is this: sex outside of a lifelong, committed, monogamous relationship with an uninfected partner of the opposite sex, it's always risky. Anytime you have sex outside of that context, of those five things, it's always risky. And what is a lifelong, committed, monogamous relationship with an uninfected partner of the opposite sex in our culture today? Well, it's marriage. That's what we call marriage. That's what marriage is. So when you have sex outside of marriage, it's always risky. You're always risking something, your mental, emotional, spiritual, physical health. I mean, STDs are, which they're calling STIs now, sexually transmitted infections, whatever. They're higher than they've ever been in our nation today. One in five Americans have an STD. That's kind of interesting and kind of crazy if you think about it. But also not if we're in a hypersexualized culture. Listen, that's not a product of unprotected sex. We don't need more education on how to protect people against this. It's a product of risky sex. Putting yourself at risk. So when you're married, you can have all the sex you want, right? And it's safe and it's healthy and it's good. Have as much sex as you want in marriage. It's great. But every time you step outside of the safety of that marriage relationship and outside of that context, which is between one man and one woman for life, we'll talk about that more next week, what marriage is. But anytime you have sex outside of that, it's always risky, every single time. It's a lot like keeping fire in a fireplace. Maybe you've heard this analogy before, maybe you haven't, but fire is both good and bad, right? Fire is great when it's in the right boundaries. It keeps you warm, you can cook with it, it's beautiful to enjoy and to look at. In some sense, we can't live without fire. If we didn't have fire, we wouldn't be able to live as humans. But as soon as it jumps out of the right boundaries, as soon as it gets outside of good context, right? As soon as it jumps out of the fireplace and onto the carpet or onto the curtains, it becomes pretty dangerous pretty quick, doesn't it? It becomes deadly even. See, that's what sex is like for us as well. As soon as it gets outside of its right context, it gets out of the safety net of marriage. man, it gets really dangerous really quickly, and it can even be deadly. So this is an argument for reason here that Paul is using. Sex outside of marriage will always hurt you and others. But then Paul says this, food is for the stomach and the stomach for food, and God will do away with them both. However, the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. Basically what Paul's doing here is he's quoting them again and saying, food is for the stomach and stomach for food. That's what you say, and you say God will do away with them both. So I think he says both of those things together. And then his response is, however, the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And the argument is just like, well, I mean, just like your body gets hungry, you satisfy it with food, right? Well, your body gets desires for sexual pleasures, so you just satisfy it with sex. It's just kind of how it is, and it doesn't really matter because we'll do away with them both. You know, I mean, we just give it what it needs, and God's going to do away with them both in the end anyway. Well, that's actually a form of Platonic dualism. If you need a philosophy lesson here again, you remember your philosophy classes in college or in high school or something like that. That's this idea that the body doesn't matter somehow. And it pits the idea of the spirit against the body, or the soul. Soul, spirit, you can use it interchangeably there in Platonic dualism. But that part, that metaphysical part of you is pitted against the physical part of you and saying, hey, the spiritual part is the thing that's important. The body's not. It's not that important at all. But listen, that's not at all what the Bible teaches. That's why Paul responds with, no, that's not it. He says, however, that's not how this thing works. Your body is actually important. It's not that your body's not important. The Bible teaches that human beings are special because we're designed in a way that's both spirit and body. We're embodied souls, you could say. And you can't really have one without the other in the human experience. A soul and spirit without a body is a ghost, right? And that's not a human experience. A body without a soul is a what? This is one of the greatest genres. Now, you guys can say it, right? It's a zombie, right? It makes good TV, but it certainly doesn't make a real human being, you know? That's not what the Bible teaches us about humans. We're both, body and spirit, and both are very important, Paul says here. Even in heaven, the Bible teaches us, we'll be embodied for eternity with God in a renewed, remade body like Jesus was after his resurrection. And that's why Paul says what he says next. So let's just read on. God raised up the Lord and will also raise us up by his power. So he's appealing to the resurrection there, saying, no, your body is important. It's not just God's going to do away with them both. No, your body is important right now. What you do with it is important right now. Don't you know your bodies are a part of Christ's body? So should I take a part of Christ's body and make it a part of a prostitute? Absolutely not. Do you know that anyone joined to a prostitute is one body with her? For the scriptures say, the two will become one flesh. He's quoting Genesis 2:24. But anyone joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. Flee sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the person who is sexually immoral sins against his own body. Don't you know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who's in you, whom you have from God? You're not your own, for you were bought with a price. So glorify God with your body. See, sex is for God's glory. That's our main point for today, right? But when we get outside of the safety of marriage, not only is it bad for us physically, but he's saying it's bad for us spiritually. It's not good. Because when we believe in Jesus, we're joined with him in a spiritual way. So there's something both bodily and spiritually that's important to understand. Paul uses the idea of sex with a prostitute to kind of illustrate his point. He's saying that sex with a prostitute, probably one of the thousand at the Temple of Aphrodite, joins together your body, which is Christ's body, if you're a believer, to a prostitute's body, which has nothing to do with Christ's body. And that's not what sex is meant to do, he's saying. Sex is meant for something more. It's meant for something greater. That's not what sex is meant to do. Sex was designed to point us to the gospel, if you want to say it like that. It was designed to point us to something greater, just like marriage is, and we'll talk about that next week. When sex is a part of marriage, then it points us to something greater. And you might be like, wait a second, that sounds a little weird. Okay, this is getting a little, I don't know about all that, right? But see, this is exactly why Paul quotes Genesis 2:24 in this verse. He says, the two shall become one flesh. And just in case you don't realize it, one flesh, it includes sex. All right, that's what Genesis is talking about from the very beginning. It's certainly not all of what it includes, but it's not less than what it includes, okay? And he does the same thing in Ephesians 5 when he goes over marriage and sex, when he's describing what marriage is there. And of course, again, we'll talk more about that next week. But for now, I want you to see the connection to sex that he makes. I'll read it from Ephesians 5:31. He says, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh." That's straight out of Genesis 2:24. This mystery is profound, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. The way the NLT actually translates it is, and this refers to Christ and the church. That's really interesting. Paul is saying Genesis 2:24, which is about physical intimacy between a husband and a wife at the very beginning that God has created, he's saying, yeah, that's a mystery, but I'm talking about how it's even more mysterious that it points to Jesus and his bride, the church, and how we relate to him. That's kind of crazy. You guys get what I'm saying there? The whole sex thing is just a living symbol of a greater reality that one day we'll completely know and be completely known by God himself. That's what sex is supposed to do. It's supposed to symbolize that greater reality for us. And Paul makes the connection and says that's what sex is actually about. And that's what Genesis 2:24 actually refers to. Something more ultimate than just physical pleasure or physical intimacy. So basically, our knowledge of God and our intimacy with God is such that we can't describe with words to a point that only the most intimate act of human connection can be pointed to and say, yeah, it's something like that. It's kind of like that. You know how sex is with a husband and a wife. That intimacy that we'll experience, that pleasure, that joy, everything, it's kind of like that when we get to heaven. So when you have sex with a prostitute, or you have sex in your mind, or with a porn star, or on your phone screen, or you have sex in any context outside of that marriage relationship, it's impacting your intimacy with God. That's what Paul is arguing here. So you can write it down like this if you're taking notes. What's physical impacts what's spiritual. The physical impacts the spiritual in this case. I don't know if you realize this or not, but what you eat can actually affect how you feel, right? Like not just physically, although it can. I mean, if I eat too much ice cream, you know, you have too much of a good thing, right? It gives you a tummy ache or something like that. You feel bad physically. But if you always make, you know, bad decisions with food, if you're always eating a lot of unhealthy things or eating out a lot, McDonald's all the time, drink a lot of sugary drinks every day, you eat junk food throughout the day, all day, you overindulge in eating in general, man, that can perpetuate depression and anxiety. It can take you down not just physically, but mentally and emotionally. It can affect you. What's physical will impact the spiritual or the emotional or the thing that is metaphysical about you. So why would sex be any different? You know? I mean, when you overindulge, so maybe you hypersexualize everyone, or when you indulge in unhealthy ways, so outside of the marriage context, then of course it's going to affect you spiritually and emotionally and mentally. It's going to do all of those things. But I think sex is both more important and less important than we usually make it out to be. I think it's both. Because it's more important because your body is for God's glory. And so sex is for God's glory. So this is ultimately a human purpose issue. It's a God's glory issue. It's ultimately a gospel issue. So it's super important, but I think it's also sometimes less important than we think because sex doesn't define you. It can't fulfill your deepest need, right? So it's kind of both more and less important than we think. It's more important because what's physical impacts what's spiritual. So when performed in God's design, sex is great. It's awesome. It's satisfying. It makes you feel good physically, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, all those things. It's an act of worship as everything else in your life should be an act. That's what Paul is talking about in all of Corinthians. 1 Corinthians is saying it should all be for God's glory. Anything you do, whether you're eating, that's an act of worship, whether you're drinking, anything you do, including sex, should be able to worship God because you're doing it within his good design. God told us to be fruitful and multiply. I mean, it's the very first command. You think about that. The very first command that he gave to humans included having sex. Man, we serve a good God, okay? That's all I've got to say. But within the right context, it's so important. So important. So it makes it much more important than a one-night stand or a commodity to be consumed or something to be trivialized in life and say, it's not that big of a deal. It's just physical and all of that. That's Platonic dualism. See, sexual sin can affect us like no other sin can. It's actually how the NLT translates it in verse 18. No other sin so clearly affects the body as this one does, is how they translate it. No other sin so clearly affects you The body is holistic there. No other sin can affect you this way because it's so important. It can leave you feeling lonely or used or frustrated at yourself or other people. There's no doubt why so many of us feel a greater measure of guilt and shame with sexual sin than any other sin that we tend to struggle with. It's probably why rape or molestation or any kind of sexual abuse is harder to talk about and heal from for survivors than any other kind of violence or abuse. Because sex is something more than just a physical act. It is physical, but it affects the spiritual. It makes it so important. But it's also not as important as we think it is either. Okay? I think that's the case because, listen, our body is for God, Paul says. It's not for sex. That's not what it's for. Our bodies weren't made to satisfy sexual cravings. Our bodies were made to glorify God and to put Him on display in the world. To put it in Paul's terms, our bodies were made to be a part of Christ's body, not a part of a prostitute's, not for sexual immorality. We were made for deep intimacy, not cheap intimacy, if I can put it that way. That's what we were made for. And sex can't do that for us. It can only be a part of that in marriage. But sex isn't the end-all be-all. You can glorify God with your body just as well by not having sex as much as you can by having sex within God's design for marriage. You realize that, right? It's not like celibate people, they can't worship God as effectively, okay? It's not like people who don't have sex can't glorify God with their lives. I mean, Jesus lived his whole life without having sex. And there was nobody more personally satisfied or fulfilled and nobody whose life was more glorifying to God than Jesus, right? I mean, we'll read in a couple of weeks, Paul's going to say, if you're single, stay single. It's better. He'll say that. It's like, don't have sex if you can't help it. Don't do it if you can do that. If you're not going to burn with passion, just don't do it. It's okay. Sex isn't the end-all, be-all experience to human life that our culture tends to make it out to be. So it's simultaneously more important and less important than we think. And what the culture does is it flips those things. The culture will get it all completely backwards. They'll trivialize it where it shouldn't be trivialized, and they'll make it so important where it shouldn't be made important. It can now identify you, your sex. You can identify in that who you want to have sex with and how you want to have sex. But, you know, it's just physical. It's not that big of a deal. Well, that's completely opposite of how the Bible talks about it. We get it backwards in the way that we think, too. This is the air that we breathe. We're in that culture. We have to look at that. We either make sex an idol or we trivialize it away in all the wrong ways. And as we do that, we're rejecting God's design for sex. And therefore, we're rejecting God. Paul asks the Corinthians a little earlier, right before this, he says, don't you know that the unrighteous, so those who don't follow God's good design, don't you know that those unrighteous will not inherit God's kingdom? Don't be deceived. No sexually immoral people or idolaters or adulterers or males who have sex with males will inherit God's kingdom. Now listen, while that's not a comprehensive list, it does summarize sexual sin up for us. It's any kind of sex outside of the marriage commitment between one man and one woman. That's not God's design. Paul uses the Greek term pornos here. It's a derivative of porneia, which is, you know, how a lot of translations will translate fornication. It's sex outside of marriage. It's illicit sex, morally wrong sex. So he's saying those who intend to keep sinning sexually because they either don't think it's wrong or they don't care that it's wrong, those people are in danger. That's what it means here, sexually immoral people. If they don't think that it's wrong or they don't care that it's wrong. And he mentions idolaters. You know, people using sex to worship themselves or worship others or worship little g gods, probably as in the temple to Aphrodite, right? He's making reference to the culture at the time. He's saying those idolaters are in danger. That's all they pursue. They want sex above anything else. They're idolaters. And then he mentions those who engage in homosexual sex here as well. They're in danger because it's not God's good design for sex. And listen, I know as we start to get specific here, this can hit each of us in different ways. And I want to be sensitive to that. I totally understand. And this is not the place where I'm going to parse out, you know, sexual theology here and ethics on sex and parse out what is sin and what is not sin necessarily. I mean, it's very clear here, though. It's not complicated. Paul's very clear on what is sin and what's not. And he just gives a summary, though. We could go over the entire Bible if we needed to. And maybe you should in a community group this week, ask some questions if you're unclear on what is sexual sin and what's not sexual sin. Totally fair question, but that's not what I'm talking about here. We're just going over the whole thing, and maybe you're here and you struggle with some of these things. If you heard the list and you're like, man, that's me. Maybe you struggle with an addiction to pornography, I mean, that's statistically speaking, it's like 1 in 4 men, 1 in 6 women, something like that. Now, this is a major issue in our culture today. Maybe that's where you're at here today. Maybe you're addicted to porn, or maybe you're constantly giving your body away. Maybe that's something that you're struggling with. You date somebody, and then you give yourself away because you want that intimacy, and then they leave, and then it's over, and you just do that over and over and over again. Maybe that's a struggle that you have. Maybe you're living with somebody that's not your spouse. Maybe you're not married to the person you're living with. Maybe you're same-sex attracted, and you frequently lust after people who are the same sex, or maybe you even go and have sex with those people oftentimes. Maybe that's where you're at. I don't know. But listen, what I want you to know, and what Paul is getting at here as he gets into the rest of the text, is you're not alone. It's okay. And you're not without hope, right? Everybody in this room has sinned sexually in some way. And I know that because of Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. You remember his teaching on lust? He's rehashing the Ten Commandments. And everybody's like, oh, the Ten Commandments, adultery's bad. You can't have sex outside of marriage, right? Jesus is like, that's right. However, it's a lot worse than you think it is, because anybody who just looks at somebody else with lust in their heart has committed adultery. You can tell me, who in this room has not looked at somebody lustfully and thought of them in a sexual way? Everybody in this room has struggled with something like this. Everybody is sexually impure in one way or another. There's not a person alive that has never struggled sexually. Just maybe some of us more than others. That might be the proclivity that we have in our lives, is sexual sin. I don't know. But listen, wherever you are on that, it doesn't matter, because there is hope for you. There is hope. Because right after Paul names these sins, he says this, and some of you used to be like this, but you were washed. You were sanctified. You were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of God. So he's saying you used to be like that. You used to see other people as objects to consume and were okay with. You used to be addicted to pornography and not think it was a problem. You used to treat sex trivially and think that it was okay. You used to solicit sex from others and thought it was normal in your life. But now, because you have believed in Jesus, even if you slip up and go back into those things, even if you fall back into sexual temptation and sin, even if you never stop lusting in your life until the day that you die, you are justified. You're being sanctified. You were washed by Jesus himself. And it's not your ability to live a sexually pure life that makes you righteous or okay. We've talked about that before. Righteousness is not being good. Righteousness means being right with God. It's a right relationship. It's relational. That's what righteousness means. Your righteousness isn't affected by you and your purity. You're never going to be pure. You're never going to be sexually pure. It's only by what Jesus has done for you that you can be made right with God. That's the point. And that's the point Paul's making here. Let me put it in a very radical way for you today, okay? 2 Corinthians 5:21 says this, "He made the one who did not know sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." So what that means for you today, if you're struggling with sexual sin, listen to this. He made the one who did not know sexual sin to be sexual sin for you, so that in him you can become sexually pure before God. In him, you can become sexually pure. That means when God looks at you, he looks at you through the lens of Jesus' purity. He doesn't see a sexual idolater, sexually immoral, adultery. That's not what he sees. When you're in Christ, when you believe in him, he sees Jesus. He sees his purity. He sees his holiness. You can write it down like this if you're taking notes, as our last note for today. Jesus took your sexual sin onto himself and away from you. That's the gospel for you. So listen, when God looks at you now and he doesn't see that broken sinner, he sees his own son. Can you believe that? Listen, here's something that I feel like all of us feel from our past. We've all heard this before. If you've been in sexual education or some kind of, you know, biblical sexual thing or whatever it is, promise keepers, I don't know what it is, okay? But you've all heard this, I guarantee it. It's the duct tape example. You guys heard this? Because this is how we think of ourselves. It's the duct tape. Man, sex is just like duct tape, okay? You stick yourself to another person, you put the duct tape on the arm, you say, see, it's like this duct tape, you're very sticking it, and it's hard to pull off, but you can do it. And when you pull it off, you rip off all the hair and all the oils and all the skin and all the dirt, and you see this piece of tape, and then you go and stick it to somebody else because you have sex with somebody else, and then you rip it off, and it's dirtier and it's grosser, and then you do it again and again and again, and finally, you can't stick anymore. You won't be able to stick. You've ruined yourself sexually. Nobody's going to want a dirty, old, used-up piece of tape, right? And that's how we think of ourselves, oftentimes. But listen, guys, that's not true. That's not what we believe. Now, the culture may think that that's what we believe as Christians, but that's not it. Because what Jesus does is he gives you a new piece of tape. He makes you completely new, right? It's not you. You're not a dirty, I mean, maybe you're a dirty, old, used-up piece of tape. I don't know, but he can replace that. That's the gospel, guys. That's the whole point of the gospel. We're broken. We're in need. We're dirty. But he makes us clean. This is what Paul says in his last verse. You're not your own, for you were bought at a price. It cost Jesus something to trade tapes with us. Okay? It cost him something. Don't let sexual sin master you. Let Jesus be your master. That's what Paul's getting at here, right? The price that he paid was the life of his own son, Jesus. You're infinitely valuable to God, even in your sexual brokenness. He knew. He knew you were going to be sexually broken. He knew you were going to get things wrong on sex. He knew that you'd reject his way in favor of your own. Listen, you don't have to walk around with that scarlet A on your chest anymore. You remember that? You remember this story? She had to walk around with a scarlet A on her chest. Everybody knew she was an adulterer. Listen, now what you can do is you can walk around with a completely snow white A on your chest. It doesn't stand for adulterer anymore. It stands for adopted. Because Jesus' scarlet blood has been poured out for you and he's cleansed you completely. Now you're changed. You're not who you once were. And maybe for those of us who have lived in sexual sin in our lives, maybe you're still in it right now, maybe part of your healing needs to be remembering the gospel so deeply that you can forgive yourself. Because listen, Jesus has forgiven you. Jesus forgive, that's what the gospel is. You are forgiven. Maybe you need to forgive yourself today. If he can extend grace to you, you can extend grace to yourself. There's no doubt Paul says, well, we got to do things in order to overcome sexual sin and temptation. Flee, he says. Flee. Do that. Put up barriers for yourself. Make sure you flee. Don't do those things. Try not to do those things. I have covenant eyes on all of my devices that get to the internet so that I have filters up, have accountability in place. Flee. Do those things. But don't forget that becoming more and more like Jesus is a lifelong process, and you probably will mess up. You probably will be sinful for the rest of your life. He's banking on that. That's the gospel. That's what the gospel is for. So make sure you give yourself grace and patience, the same grace and patience that Jesus has shown you. And remember who he is to you. You might feel condemned from all sides, like the woman caught in adultery in John chapter 8, who was ready to be stoned by all the religious leaders. Do you remember this story? A lot of people are like, it shouldn't be in the Bible. I don't care. It's a great story because it really reflects who Jesus is to us, right? I mean, we're all like that woman who's caught in adultery, she deserved to be stoned, they said, according to the law. And they were doing it to trap Jesus, but Jesus used it as a gospel opportunity, because what did Jesus say? He's down there on the ground. You remember that? He's on the ground. He's drawn. He's listening to all of their, you know, negativity and all of their religious, you know, legalism and all of this. She deserves it. She deserves it. And he's down on the ground writing. We don't know what he's writing. And he says, the one who doesn't have sin in his life should cast the first stone. What happens? They all just kind of look around at each other and they're kind of dumbfounded. They all walk away one by one, drop their stones, because nobody is without sin except for one person. The person who's down there drawn in the dirt, right? He's the one without sin. And he says the person without sin is the one to cast the first stone. They all walk away because they know they're sinful. And he stands up and he turns to the woman and he looks at her right in her face. And he looks at her in the eyes and he says, where'd they go? Does anybody stand here to condemn you? And she says, no one, Lord. Nobody's here to condemn me. And he says, neither do I.
neither do I condemn you. Now go and don't sin anymore. That's what Jesus does for us. That's what he's done for you in your sexual brokenness. That's what he's done for me. Makes me think of the hymn, and I'll close with this. Turn your eyes upon Jesus, just like he did for her. He looked at the woman, looked her in the face. So now you turn your eyes upon Jesus and look full in his wonderful face. And the things of earth, all the sexual brokenness, all of that, that'll all grow strangely dim in light of his glory and grace. Let me pray.